Have you been told that you care too much? Do you have a special interest that you could talk about for hours?
I'm Alex.
And I'm David.
Join us and hear why we think there's no such thing as caring too much. So, as some of you listening may be aware, or maybe not, I don't know if you know me, but I, not too long ago, moved from Toronto, Ontario to Montreal, Quebec. And as it turns out, there's some pretty significant differences in how housing, and particularly how rental housing is organized between those two jurisdictions. So today we are talking about housing.
But not only today are we talking about housing, we will be talking about housing in the next episode and the one after, because we decided to, we didn't decide that this topic was big. This topic is just gigantic. And so it's going to take us three episodes to kind of cover all the things that we wanted to go through.
Yeah. So today we'll specifically be talking about renting and like kind of what the different situations are in Ontario and Quebec. And providing a bit of an introduction for those of you who haven't heard of housing before. What is it? Why do we care? And all of that important baseline information.
And I mean, we're talking about Ontario and Quebec because those are the places that we have our experience with. But we're also talking about this will also cover a lot of things that I think will be hopefully at least relevant to most people living in any sort of place where the rental systems work similarly. America, I think a lot of countries in Europe are fairly similar. Australia, perhaps.
Maybe even the rest of Canada that's not in Ontario or Quebec.
Well, I mean, we're certainly going to be covering. We've got lots of statistics on things across Canada, but hopefully, even if you're outside of Canada, there will still be. You know, I mean, from what research that I did, it seems like while there are certainly some unique things happening in the housing market, you know, in probably every individual market. Overall, the whole world kind of seems to be on the same trend with regard to housing, and it's not a great one. So,
as we will learn,
yes.
So, personally, I have had some fun times looking for apartments, looking at apartments. There's a lot of like really bad housing out there. And so I was wondering, David, do you have any stories about place hunting?
I have a lot of stories. I moved out of my parents' house in 2015, I believe. Yeah, 2015 was when I started university. And I was very, very lucky. A family member had bought a house in Toronto many years previously for my cousins to live in. And then after my cousins are quite older than me, after they moved out, she was renting it out to usually people that she knew, like just by chance, there was always someone that she kind of knew that needed a place. And so I was lucky enough for the first 2 years to be in a place, like I knew where I was going. I knew the landlord, it was my aunt, and like things were really great. But from 2017 onwards, I think I've lived in 8 different places in not that many years.
Yeah, that's that does sound like more places than years, intermittent.
Yeah, and a lot of it was because I worked in the student residence complex while I was a student in university. And so sometimes they move you at the end of each semester. But excluding those two experiences, I've had to, you know, fill out a rental agreement and all that stuff 4 different times. And all 4 of those times, it was as hard or harder than finding a job. And this was all in Toronto for context. I've always lived in Toronto or very, very close to it. And each one, and each time was completely different. Like, it was difficult for a completely different reason. One time I was hunting in the middle of a pandemic that people may have heard of. One time I was hunting right after the pandemic, where all of the house prices shot sky high. So it's always been rough going for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember when I was apartment hunting in downtown Toronto in the middle of the aforementioned pandemic, there were some, like, even with the entire area as empty as it's probably been in decades, and with, you know, landlords struggling to find tenants to fill the gaps of people who had left, there was, like, no room for flexibility, no bargaining. I would call it less a market, honestly, and more of just, like, renters take what they can get a lot of the time. And often
100%.
What they can get is not great housing for a lot of money.
No, that, I feel like that's exactly the situation. Like, it's ridiculous that it took a pandemic to make it, quote unquote, a better market for renters. But even that better market was still very difficult. I think I applied to, like, fully put in a full application that was, you know, the 2 or 3 pages that are required with all of your, you know, you need to put in your bank information and you need a guarantor if you don't make $1 million a year, all this sort of stuff. Not just, like, you know, hitting an interested button on, like, Zillow.com. Even during the pandemic, it took, like, 5 or 6 of those long applications until finally found a place. And yeah, it wasn't even, like, it's not like, oh, there was a huge discount. The discount or whatever that kind of came into play during the pandemic, at least from what I saw and what was available, was basically just, oh, rent didn't go up during the pandemic. It's not that it, like, dropped by half or something, whatever. It was just like, oh, it's not going up by an exorbitant amount every single month.
Yeah, I do remember as well, after leaving that apartment that I eventually found, you know, living there for 2 years. And then once we notified the landlord that we weren't renewing our lease, within 1 week of listing the place, they had found a new tenant who was paying, I think, $400 or $500 a month more than us.
I thought you were going to say way more than that.
I mean, we were already paying a lot, so.
No, I know. I'm not saying that that's good. I'm just saying, like, even hearing, oh, my rent got raised, or not your rent, the rent in an apartment got raised $400 or $500 from one tenant to the next. Like, I've been hearing, like, oh, the landlord raised it $1,500, $2,000. Like, there, I think there was a story in the news recently. There were two young women who had got a place. I want to say they were sisters or cousins, and their apartment wasn't rent controlled. And we'll get to the rent controlled versus non-rent controlled in Ontario, I'm sure. But theirs wasn't rent controlled, and their landlord just decided out of nowhere to raise their rent, like, a couple $1,000s a month, because ultimately they wanted them to move out, and so that was their mechanism of doing that. But it's, overall, it, you're 1,000,000% right on the fact that I don't think it's fair to call it a market. It's kind of a, you're, like, blindfolded and you reach into a bag that is mostly filled with piranhas, but you might be lucky and you might grab the keys to a place that you're not going to want to cry every time you go home.
I think that's a fairly apt description, but my ears perked up when you mentioned rent control, because, you know, I'm in law school. I can't talk about a topic without making it a legal framework. And so how does rent control work in Ontario? Like, What does that mean? How extensive is it? All of those things.
Well, so I think the first thing, since this is, since I am not a law student, I'm just going, you know, full disclosure, I'm going based off of my opinions here, not the law. I don't think it should
for
be
what
called
it's worth.
Control.
For what it's worth, nothing that I say on this podcast is or should be construed as legal advice. Please don't take any actions. Consult a lawyer if you want to know about the law. Carry on, David.
I'm gonna like click that, and then I'm gonna make like a button that I hit anytime that we're talking about stuff in future episodes where it just replays that sound bite.
Thank you. Save me some effort.
Save you some future legal issues. Yeah, I don't think it should be called rent control because it's not really rent control. Like, your rent is not controlled even in the buildings where they say you have rent control, because the rent can change from one tenant to the next, which is like, yeah, sure, as long as you stay in one place, the rent won't change. But people have to move all the time, like for fun, just because they got bored of the place or, you know, something was wrong with the place or needed to move for work or whatever. And true rent control would say, here is a fair market price for your for this unit. You cannot raise it by more than whatever inflation is, or if you do renovations and the actual market price changes. But all we have in Ontario, which we'll also get to, some places don't even have this, is that as long as the same tenant is in the place, the rent can't be raised more than whatever the inflation amount is for that year. And then on top of that, in 2018, Doug Ford got rid of rent control on any new buildings. So now in Ontario, there's, I think, what I've seen many advocates refer to as vacancy control as opposed to rent control. And I like that more. We have vacancy control on anything older than 2018, and it is the Wild West on anything that's been built newer in the last, you know, 5 years. And there's unfortunately not really much that municipalities or anything can do because all of those laws are ultimately up to the provincial government in Ontario. And so that's kind of the situation that renters face in Ontario. And I think it has led to, well, I mean, I can't say that Doug Ford created our crisis, the housing crisis, but I definitely believe that he has enabled it to continue and get worse in many cases because of the way that he's managed a lot of different things. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's the landlord and tenant board, but definitely that removal of rent control or vacancy control on new buildings, I think, is just, it clearly only benefits one group of people, and it's the people who already have enough money to be buying and owning tons of properties.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, you know, we discussed this already, but it's a little bit ridiculous to consider housing to be a free market situation when people who need housing need housing. Maybe they have a choice in where they get housing, but they don't really have a choice in whether or not to seek housing. And on the other hand, people who own rental housing do have a choice, right? They can take a loss by not renting out their rental housing if they think waiting a year will get them something better. And so it's not a situation of even bargaining power. There's no invisible hand at play here, keeping rents fair. We can see that quite clearly if we look at how rents have been trending. And you have some information on that, right?
Courtesy of the rentals.ca National Rent Report, which says it was authored by Urban Nation. I don't actually know what that Urban Nation is, but I know that this is the, you know, the rental report that kind of is used across all across Canada, actually, to kind of gauge how affordable and what is going on in the rental markets across the country. And on average, the report, the most recent report, February 2024, showed that in Canada, there was about a 10% increase in rents, bringing the new average for all residential rentals to $2,200 per month.
So is that 10% from last February?
Yes. So that's mm-hmm. the like the annual increase from, I think the report comes out in February, but it's like done with the numbers of the previous year. So I think it's like the February 2024 report covers January to December 23. So over 1 year, there was a 10% increase, bringing the average rate to 2,200. And that's all residential property types. So that's the average of single bedrooms to three bedrooms all across Canada.
And
we do
so,
have a lot more specific numbers that we'll get into later. But yeah, it's for the average cost to find a place to live, $2,200 a month. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, that's not affordable for most people.
Yeah, and that 10% number is really ridiculous as well. Over the course of 1 year, you know, inflation isn't 10%. You might get 10% on like an aggressive investment portfolio. But for the value of housing, you know, such a basic human need, to increase by 10% over the course of the year, I think goes to show exactly how ineffective measures like this kind of vacancy control structure are, because it's not truly putting a brake on how fast housing costs can increase. As you said, people have to move all the time.
Yeah, it's not something, I mean, aside from the fact that that super basic supply and demand graph that everyone thinks of when they, if they didn't take any more than like, you know, basic economics, aside from the fact that that has basically been debunked, it's never applied to a situation where the demand is not, it's elastic, right? That's what economists call it when it, like when things change, like it's never going to change that people need somewhere to live, right? Like it cannot, the market cannot operate the way that a lot of people just think, oh yeah, that's how the market operates, it'll always balance out. Like, no, it won't. There need to be guidelines and safety things in place, because otherwise we have, you know, what we're already on track to, which is the corporations that a lot of the times are not even based in Canada are the ones that own the majority of the real estate, and they get to control with a monopoly over housing. Like, that's what we're heading towards. And that's pretty scary to me as someone who does not have a, I don't know, a trust fund or whatever that's going to insure me a house in 10 years or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll get to this as we continue this series, so I don't want to dwell too much on it now. But fundamentally, it doesn't really matter who owns the housing supply, whether it's individual small-scale landlords or corporations, whether it's domestic owners, foreign, whoever, as long as housing is being treated more as a commodity and an investment than as a basic human need, then there's always going to be this kind of a problem. And that's the root of the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And now what would, you know, I'm sure there's people out there who will be like, oh, we just went through a pandemic, you're throwing around this 10%. I know we have some stats on from before the pandemic as well. And so that same like renters report from February 2024 also covered that sort of issue, and it found that compared to January 2020, before any lockdowns started, The average rent in Canada has increased by 20%, or about $400 per month. The monthly price of rent has gone up by $400. It has not increased by $400 every month since January 2020, which is the first thought I had when I read this. And I'm like, whoa, there's no way that's 20%. But then I remembered how to do math properly.
Yeah. So if anyone else was a renter kind of around the pandemic years, you'll remember all of these like, oh, come rent for 12 months and we'll give you an extra month for free, or
we'll drop the rent
by like, yeah, we'll drop the rents by $10 a month. Or more Ooh, often, we just won't increase them.
Swimming in pennies.
but I think it is worth acknowledging. It was quite remarkable that in places, including urban centers like Toronto, rents were not really increasing for a year or two, specifically in the downtown cores.
Yeah, I think the statistic like definitely shows like if from 2023 to 2024, there was a 10% increase, but from 2020 to 2024, there was a 20% increase. There was obviously stuff that happened in the pandemic, but we've still ended up in a worse place. Like the pandemic made things, you know, it opened up a little bit of breathing room, maybe is the right way to put it.
But
that breathing room is all gone now.
And the bar is very low, right? For what constitutes yes. breathing room. We are not talking about significant reductions. The housing market and the rental market here doesn't fall. The question is it going up really fast, or is it going up a little bit slower?
Yes.
So that's the context we're in. And even something as massive as the COVID-19 pandemic, people fleeing urban centers, you know, headlines about this crisis for landlords, all that means is that rent was going up less than 10% per year. So
yep. we have... And that was something that we were all celebrating. Like that was in the moment. I remember it feeling so great. And now I'm looking back on it and I'm like, it didn't even matter. Like it really didn't change much.
Hey, I mean, without that, maybe we'd be looking at 30 or 40%. Over the course of that time. But no, you're right. Like True. People are not in a livable situation. So we've heard a little bit about Ontario's vacancy control, rent control, whatever you want to call it. What other rights do renters have in Ontario? How else can people protect themselves?
So I came up with this since I've been... You know, I mean, we've both been renters in Ontario, but I've been doing it for longer. And I kind of, you know, in the preparation of this episode, kind of made sense for me to focus on Ontario and you to focus on some of the things specific to Quebec, since I've never lived there. I thought it would be fun to throw a second little game into our episode today. I know we always do our game during the break, but I thought this would be a more fun way to kind of go through the list of rights as opposed to just listing them out. We can still kind of cover them all, but we'll turn it into a game. So I was gonna kind of go through, there's a lot of different headings, I guess, under the your rights as a tenant in Ontario. And so I was gonna kind of ask, you know, for example, what is a landlord allowed to evict you for? And then give you kind of like three options, and one of them will be wrong. And we'll kind of go through the basics of your tenants' rights in Ontario, like that, if you're up for that game, Alex.
Yeah, sounds like a blast. I would love to know what my hypothetical Ontario landlord couldn't evict me for. So let's do it.
Okay, so I mean, we'll start with that one because I think that's a pretty common thing that happens, is that landlords often know that you are allowed to evict a tenant for personal reasons, but they don't actually know what those personal reasons are. And I think a lot of the times they hope that the tenant doesn't know either. So of these three options, which one of these is incorrect? A tenant is allowed to evict you for personal use if they would like to use the unit themselves, like they are going to move into it. If they are going to be, like, if they have someone who they know, who, like, they've found someone else that is like, hey, I know you have a place, whatever, their colleagues, work friends, whatever. Or if they would like to have a family member move in to the unit, what are they allowed to evict you for?
So I'm going to say 1 and 3, they are allowed to evict you for, but 2, they are not allowed to evict you for.
You're correct, but it was a little bit of a trick question because you're correct. They are only allowed to evict you if they're going to be moving in or if a direct family member is moving in. But if a friend is going to be moving in, they cannot evict you unless the friend is buying the place. So they can sell the place to a friend, and then the friend can, you know, that friend is now the owner, so they're going to use it themselves. But they cannot just start renting it to a friend or a colleague or some random person that is not a relative.
So if your landlord's friend becomes your landlord, they can then kick you out to move in, but your landlord cannot directly kick you out so their friend can move in.
Exactly. And I feel like that's a fine print thing that a lot of either landlords will just genuinely not understand the difference or might hope that they could, you know, sneak one over on their tenants and take advantage of them. So good to know that it can only be, you can only be evicted for another renter if that renter is the landlord themselves or a direct family member. What about something that I think we hear a lot, rent evictions? What are the three sort of things that fall under rent evictions that tenants have some protections for? Renovations, repairs, and if they're demolishing things. So I feel like a lot of times that isn't going to apply to like apartments. That's more to maybe detached or semi-detached houses, because I don't think most apartment buildings would be okay if you just started demolishing things in a shared building. But
so
protections do you have from those three things? Because this was actually completely news to me.
So I would guess, I would certainly hope that a tenant has protection if they have to move out for repairs to be done temporarily, that they would then be able to move back in once the repairs are complete.
Yes, you are correct. And actually you have that right for all three of those: renovations, repairs, or demolitions. You have they call it something weird, the right of first refusal. But you have the right to move back in once a renovation, repair, or demolition is complete. And if your landlord fails to do that, you are able to get compensation. And if the landlord fails to do that willingly, the landlord and tenant board can actually enforce that. So if you are rent evicted, you actually are entitled to compensation if they don't let you move back in.
So in the case of a renovation, you know, you mentioned, and I think we all know that this is something that happens, that landlords will undergo renovations in order to increase what they can rent a place out for. Is a tenant protected at the same rent before a renovation and afterwards? Or would they have to move back in for a higher rent?
I think for a renovation, because that is something that is, sorry, I don't think, I know for, since renovations are covered under like the, yeah, renovation is a valid reason to increase rent. That is true, but because this process is protect, like there is landlord and tenant oversight from the landlord and tenant board. If, for example, your landlord was to, I don't know, they put in some new appliances, a new sink and a new fridge, whatever, and a new dishwasher, because that would actually require some like work. And they decide to raise the rent by $3,000 a month. I think that that would be very clearly a case that the landlord and tenant board would be like, that's not, there's no way that a new sink, dishwasher, and fridge increased the value of the apartment by $3,000. You are trying to get around this rule. But unfortunately, with most of these things, these all require you as the tenant to kind of stand up for yourself and then be willing to take this fight to the landlord and tenant board. So, I mean, that's the obvious downside to it. It's you have the protection, but, you know, it could be a long fight, especially right now. The wait times for the LTB are absolutely ridiculous. But I think it's really important to know that you do have that right if you want to fight for it. I know that a lot of the times fighting, it might just be easier for you and better to find a new place. And like, that is the reality that sucks about kind of like the situation, the way that the system works. But if you do want to stand up for your rights, you are able, you have the right to move back into a place following a renovation or a repair.
Yeah. All right. Any other tenants' rights questions on the board?
The last one was another thing that was completely surprising to me as someone who thought they were well informed on these issues, since I had spent, I don't know, like 6 months looking for this place that I'm currently in not too long ago. Ontario recently updated the standard lease that you are required to use. When was the lease updated? And what penalty do you think that landlords could face if they fail to use this new lease that is meant to be more like clear language and explain the complicated things more clearly to everyone involved?
So I have no idea when the standard lease in Ontario was last updated. I'm not even going to guess on that one, because it could be any time, as far as I'm concerned.
So I was surprised because it was updated in 2021, which is after Doug Ford was in power. So I don't know if this is something that was already in the works and he just didn't stop, or if there's some really good people that have managed to not get canned in the housing department under him or whatever. But in 2021, they released a new standard lease that was a pretty significant improvement over the old version, which just made it very hard to, you know, it was always referencing some law that you would have to go and look up. This new one's very like plain language and everything. And
that's if your great. Wait, landlord, but I want to guess the penalty.
Okay. I was going to say the penalty, but what's the penalty if you sign a lease and then you are living in the place and you find out that, oh my gosh, they didn't use the lease that Ontario requires them to?
So my guess, if a landlord doesn't use the standard lease, is like a fine of some kind is my guess. And I would take a shot in the range of like maybe around or below $1,000.
You're not wrong, but I mean, technically you are wrong. But in terms of the outcome for the landlord, you pretty much got it. If a landlord refuses to give you the proper lease, you are entitled to withhold 1 month's rent.
Oh, that's, I mean, as we've just learned, that's more than $1,000.
That is more than $1,000 in most cases.
And at least the tenant benefits from it as well.
That's what I liked about it too. Like it's not just a penalty for the landlord. It's also a recognition of, hey, your landlord was doing something, you know, maybe they were just doing it out of ignorance. They didn't know there was a new lease, but either way, your landlord did not give you all the proper things that you are entitled to. So you get a free month. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I didn't.
All right.
The one thing that I didn't think I would find in this episode in doing the research was something good to say about any developments in the housing area from our government in the last couple years. But, you know, I'm always happy to be surprised.
I'm with you there. And on that happy note, I think it's about time that we go into our break and play our second game of the day. Welcome to our break. The game that we're going to be playing today is a little sneak peek at the rental markets in our respective cities. So each of us is going to go ahead and describe a rental that we have found listed on the internet available right now. And then we are going to guess how much each of these cost. So David, do you want to kick us off with some Toronto housing?
Yes. So let's first start off, and I'll go through this slowly so that like anyone listening, and also you can like take a note if you want to just remember the like the location and the basic facts of the place, and then I'll talk about the vibes of the place, and then you can guess. So we have a 3-bed, 3-bathroom condo right at Yonge and Carleton, or Yonge and College. It is on the 41st floor. And if you are familiar with Toronto, it is that building right at Yonge and Carleton, like right across from the Bulk Barn, that has like one of the sort of sides of the tower is like a cylinder. So it's a pretty noticeable building, like on the skyline, or if you're familiar with that area.
I know the one.
Okay, perfect. So that's the building we're looking at. Now, let's talk about the vibes of this place. When you walk in to this unforgettable condo, you are entering into a grand foyer, which is about 10 by 10 feet wide. Then you have the option to head down a hallway to the joint dining room, living room, kitchen area, which takes up about half of the condo. And off of the living room is in the cylinder part. And so there is like a wraparound balcony that goes around that entire circular part, which is the living room. And then if instead of going that way from the grand foyer, you go the other way to the 3 bedrooms. You've got a main bedroom with an ensuite. You've got a second bedroom with an ensuite. And then we've got the 3rd bedroom, which could also be the den. All of the bedrooms have floor-to-ceiling windows, as well as most of the dining, kitchen, living room. It's just windows. You're looking at a panorama of the city, and you face north. And there is a washer and dryer in one of the bathrooms.
And what's the kitchen space like? Like, is there a kitchen island? I'm very interested in this.
So the way the kitchen is set up is, think like Kardashian kitchen, in the sense, not the looks necessarily, but in the sense that this is a kitchen meant for someone who hires someone to do their cooking, I would say, because the kitchen is sort of small. It's kind of like a galley kitchen, but there's 2 double doors on each side of the kitchen. So like on one side you walk in, you know, from the hallway, grand foyer, and then you're in the galley kitchen. And if you keep walking through and walk through the other set of double doors, you're into like the dining room. So it's not a super big or nice kitchen on its own, but it's giving me vibes of like, oh, that's where the hired help would make the dinners and then bring it out to you in the luxurious dining living space.
I remember this from my time apartment hunting in Toronto. I have such rage for whoever decided it was acceptable to put a subpar kitchen in a luxury condo. I think whoever first made that decision should be beheaded, probably.
Certainly not allowed dead, near real estate.
If they're dead, they should maybe be dug up and beheaded again. It's just deeply offensive to me that you're allowed to build a beautiful, stunning, like, luxurious living space, and then the kitchen is an afterthought. I don't care who's cooking. I don't care if you're ordering Uber Eats every single day. If it's a nice house, it should have a nice kitchen.
I might have been underselling. Like, it's a nice kitchen. It's one of the nicest kitchens I've seen. It's just, whenever I see a galley kitchen, I'm like, oh, that's not a good kitchen. Like, it is by far the nicest galley kitchen I've ever seen, though. So I want to make that clear.
Even so.
But I agree that overall you're correct. This kitchen should not be allowed in this apartment.
My guess is that this place is going for $6,500 a month.
Okay, and for all of you at home, there's no way for us to know what your guesses were, but congratulate yourself if you guessed $6,000 a month. You were pretty close.
All right.
Alex, I honestly, I'm surprised that it is this cheap. Not that $6,000 a month is cheap, but for 3-bed, 3-bath, and for the quality of this place that I'm looking at and stuff, I'm even $6,500 would have been lower than what I would have guessed.
I think it's just limited demand for this particular type of condo. Like, I think most people with $6,000 a month to throw at housing would probably prefer to buy.
Yeah, they don't want to live at 21 Carlton. And also, I didn't mention this because but there is a canoe hanging from the wall in their living room. I mean, that just speaks to the current residents' lack of taste, but I thought that was interesting. There is a full canoe hanging above their TV in this apartment. Hey,
I mean, storage space is hard to come by in Toronto condos.
If you're an avid canoer and you've got $6,000 a month to throw away, we have an apartment for you. Head on to Zillow right now. But okay, I'm excited to guess now. What have you found in the beautiful city of Montreal that I get to guess?
All right. So I have actually gone on a total, like, left turn away from the traditional Montreal condo. We are looking at something today that is basically brand new. Built 2023, and this is in a building down the street from me. I have seen this building go up. We are, you know, kind of east of downtown, technically right across the road that defines the downtown area, but I would say downtown starts somewhat more west.
So just to put it in a Toronto perspective, because, I mean, I think most people who might be listening are friends from Toronto. You're saying, like, if this was Toronto, like, you're somewhere around, like, Bloor-ish in terms of relation to downtown, or, like, Eglinton in relation to downtown?
Neither of those places. The problem is the measure of distance in Toronto, I feel like, is totally different from, like, what vibe you get, how far out from downtown you are. Like, I feel like the vibe in this area is a little bit like, you know, the, like, largely student housing area around Ossington, Like you'll walk down these streets and it's like townhouses, three stories high. Each floor is kind of rented out separately.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that usually like around Bloor? Where that kind of like housing is? Even if it's going out as far as Ossington, but like...
Maybe. The level of centrality this neighborhood is... Like, if you walk for 40 minutes, you're in the downtown core.
Okay, for sure. You're like, obviously it's not a direct comparison, but you're like somewhere around like Bloor-ish in terms of Toronto terms. Okay.
Sure. To me, because I grew up in North York, Bloor is still downtown for me. But maybe that's it. My disconnected upbringing. I didn't even grow up
in the city. What do you...
Doesn't matter. We can cut that part before I embarrass myself on live television.
Yeah, to our millions of viewers.
So this is a new building, sort of fair proximity to downtown. It's a lively area, maybe 10 minutes walk from the metro, if that.
Okay.
10 minutes walk, if that, from a big and beautiful park in the other direction from the metro. You know, lots of stuff all around. This condo is 1,468 square feet. It's got it covers two levels. There's a ground floor and a basement.
I love that kind of apartment. Oh my gosh, when I see a set of stairs in an apartment, I'm immediately sold.
But wait till you hear this. There's a ground floor, there's a basement. And then there is a rooftop balcony.
Okay. I mean, I'm already in Toronto numbers. We're like at 10,000 a month, but okay.
All right. We have a grand total of four bedrooms.
Ooh, okay.
Most of them are in the basement. It's like, you know, the kind of half basement thing you can do where there's a window at least, but it's a basement. There is a kitchen island.
Ooh, okay.
It's got the, you know, the kind of open living room, kitchen, dining room sort of like vibe. Only two bathrooms. One is an ensuite downstairs. One is upstairs. Wait, I take it back. The downstairs one is not an ensuite. I was reading the floor plan wrong. Two bathrooms is the point. Okay. And in addition to the rooftop balcony, there is another, it looks like from these photos, smaller balcony attached to the ground floor.
Damn. That is fancy. Okay, what about laundry?
So these pictures don't actually reveal laundry to me, nor does the description. And part of that, I think, is because in Quebec, it's much more normal for people to move with their appliances. So like the people moving in would probably have to bring or buy their own laundry machines, but I would guess there's laundry hookups.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big difference. Like, I feel like a building or a unit that has in-unit laundry and in-building laundry, they're like they're basically the same thing in the grand scheme of things. It's once you have to go to an external laundromat, I feel like that brings the price down noticeably.
But yeah, so this is the executive summary, almost 1,500 square feet. Four bedroom, two bathroom, brand new building, couple of balconies. It's like the full, bring the whole family, live your happy Montreal life. And what kind of price tag are we putting on this?
So yeah, from what you've described, I'm picturing that this is either ideal for a, lower income family, or for like students, young professionals who are all going to be like roommates. That's what I'm getting from this. I think it's probably more meant for family, since 4-bed, 2-bath is not the best ratio if you're like all random roommates and not like related to each other. So the fact that it's brand new, I'm going to guess that 4-bed, 2-bath. See, like, I want to guess, my head is going to like, okay, 3,000 a month or something like that. But I know from all the conversations I've had with you that every time we talk about a place, it is incredibly lower than what I thought. So I'm going to guess that this is 2,100 a month.
Unfortunately, your first instinct was actually right here. So this place is $2,990 a month.
Damn it, I should have stuck with my gut.
For 2,100, if we take a really quick look on Centris over here, which for anyone who is looking at renting in Montreal, look for listings on Centris, not any other like real estate place, because that's where you're going to find it. But for $2,100 a month, you can get a 921 square foot 2-bed, 2-bath.
Already unheard of in Toronto
for that price. And it's like a townhouse style condo, this place I'm looking at here. Got a brick wall. Actually also on 2 floors. So you could get something pretty nice for $2,100 a month.
Yeah. I mean, I think that either way that those prices, I think, are wildly beating a similar or comparable thing in Toronto. So I think this definitely confirmed, this has definitely solidified why I understand now why you are always encouraging us to look at places in Montreal, because it seems to be a whole different ballgame.
It really is a little bit.
Well, speaking of ballgames, that is the end of our game for this little break today. Thanks for playing along. Hope you were more correct than we were with our guesses, but we'll head right back into the episode now. Welcome back. Now that we've spent a good couple minutes having some fun with our games, we're going to dive fully into some of these differences that mostly Alex has learned about by moving to a different jurisdiction. And I think we will hopefully also learn more about why Alex has been an incredibly strong advocate to our entire friend group about why all of us should move to Montreal. I'm very curious to learn more about what the reasons are behind your incredibly strong beliefs in Montreal being a better place for renters than Toronto is. Not that I find it hard to believe, but I'm curious to learn more.
Yeah, so we'll set aside the, clearly superior cultural scene, the food, the people, all of that, the fluff.
Sorry,
we'll leave the fluff aside for now and go straight to, the different legal frameworks in place between Ontario and Quebec. Because...
Oh, I need that button. Where's... Please do not take any of this as actual legal advice.
That's right. I'm not a lawyer. By law, only lawyers and notaries can offer legal advice, and I'm neither of those things. But as you might know, if you know about the division of powers in sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution of Canada, housing
is... Which all of us are intimately familiar with. But for the case of those woefully uneducated who do not know, I think you should probably enlighten us on what those sections are.
Basically, the takeaway here is that housing is a provincial responsibility. The provinces make the laws related to housing. That's not something that happens at the federal level. And so that's why we end up with different housing laws between different provinces. And so Quebec's housing framework is distinct from Ontario's in a number of ways. Now, that's not the only thing that's different between the two places. You know, even between Toronto and Montreal, the two biggest cities in Canada, Toronto is still like twice the size of Montreal. And the built environments are distinct in character. You know, Montreal has a lot of what in Toronto you might call the missing middle. We found it here.
That's where it all went.
Yeah, so
it's been in Montreal. It's speaking French.
We have a ton of, you know, mid-rise buildings. I live right now in a three-story condo building with 7 units in total. A lot of older buildings, so it's not this huge rush to like tear things down and build and incur that extra cost. And that also kind of means that the living spaces tend to be nicer. You know, it's not all the brand new condo style, how many bedrooms can we fit into 600 square feet deal. There's a little bit more space to live in the standard floor plans here.
Well, but so, and again, you're the expert, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I also think that, like, I mean, just the fact that you said, like, it's nicer, I think it's an interesting conversation there, because I'm sure there's some people who like the monstrosities that they're building in Toronto and that I currently live in, where everything is gray and there's no personality and it's very tight and compact. But the, like, what's the right word for, like, a place that doesn't have all the bells and whistles, but it's just like a solid foundation? Like, you know, you've got good walls, a good floor, absolutely nothing fancy, but like, that's it. Like, I feel like that's a lot more easy to find in Montreal than it is in Toronto. And it's,
I would agree with that. It's not like we don't have any of the giant condo buildings. Like, this is still a major urban center in the 21st century. But they're mostly confined to a relatively small area of downtown, and a great deal more of the city than Toronto, which to me is very characterized by a sharp contrast between huge condo or apartment buildings and these like sprawling single family home neighborhoods. A lot more of Montreal's ground space footprint, whatever you want to call it, is taken up by this like comfortable mid-density. Like, you can fit a whole lot more people into a neighborhood here than, for example, where I grew up in Toronto, which, you know, has individual lots that are maybe close to the size of like my building's footprint. Yeah, exactly. So the law isn't all of it, right? How a city is constructed definitely plays a role. And the last thing I want to say is I think desirable housing locations are a little bit more widely distributed here, in part because of how our transit system and like the metro system is built. It's easier to be close to the metro. And so you don't have to like pack yourself into downtown just to be able to get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I'm just curious, like, I don't know if you know this like specifically, because it's not really related to housing. It's more just a fun fact. Is that, do you think that difference in like, you know, the missing middle, whatever you want to call it, the fact that there's that, is that like an influence from like France versus in Britain at the time that wasn't really a thing, and that's why Toronto got built differently than Montreal? Or like,
so this I don't know, but I do know that Montreal is an older city than Toronto. And I think that might have something to do with it in terms of still having that European sensibility a little bit when a lot of Montreal was being built. You know, North Americans will call Montreal a European city in North America. It's not. Like European cities are quite different from from this, but I think being an older city is maybe connected more to not yet having that desire to have like these big flashy homes in the middle of an urban center.
Yeah, for lack of a better word, it hadn't been Americanized yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but with all of that out of the way, there definitely is a different legal framework here as well. And in terms of the substantive rights, it's not like hugely different. The same basic rule of vacancy control exists, that while one tenant is living in a building, you know, the landlord can only raise the rent by a reasonable amount. And that amount is set each year, not actually directly by the government, but by the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, the TAL, which is our equivalent of the Landlord-Tenant Board. And in between tenants, you don't have quite the same protection, but there's a significant difference in that landlords are legally obliged to provide new tenants with the lowest rent paid in the last several years.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's not substantive so much, but it does help people understand if they're getting a fair deal on a place. And one of the other major differences is who bears the burden when a rent increase or a, you know, rental right is contested. So the basic procedure here for lease renewal, for example, is that if neither the landlord nor the tenant say anything, the lease renews automatically on the same terms at the same rent.
And okay, so that's the same as Ontario.
Yeah, and if the landlord wants to increase the rent, they have to send a notice to the tenant. And if the tenant replies to the landlord and says, in writing, I am refusing the rent increase, it's the landlord's job to then take that to the TAL and argue to be able to increase the rent.
So they're, even if it's within the guideline, they can refuse it?
Yeah. I mean, if you refuse a within guideline rent increase, you probably will lose at the TAL.
But still, that's huge that it still requires them, because I'm pretty sure the way that it works in Ontario is if you refuse it, the landlord's like, okay, well, you're out. And like, that's kind of like, it's nice that there is that extra step where the landlord has to go to the TAL to prove that they're at least doing everything right before it's just eviction time.
Yeah, exactly. And another big instrument here that I really didn't hear anything about in Ontario is lease transfers, what we would call cession de bail. And that is actually something that's under attack by Quebec's very conservative provincial government right now. But
Monsieur Legault,
the very one, but at least up to this point, right? And notwithstanding any future changes in the law, any tenant has the right to transfer their lease to someone else, and the landlord has to show a serious reason to refuse the lease transfer. For example, that the new tenant wouldn't be able to pay rent. And again, if the landlord wants to refuse a lease transfer, it's their responsibility to take it to the TAL and argue their case. And if a lease is transferred, then you don't get the gap between tenants that allows landlords to raise rent. So lease transfers are widely used here to keep rents low, even between tenants, even with people having to move around. And the change that the current government has proposed is that a landlord would now be able to refuse a lease transfer for any reason, not just a serious, you know, and fully justified reason, which would basically take those away as a form of long-term rent control.
That's definitely, so you're saying that that's like a mechanism that is like widely advertised or at least widely known about in Quebec, whereas
It's widely known about and it's widely used.
That's very interesting to me, because I actually found out in the process of like my last rent, that's also a process that you're allowed to do in Ontario, and it's similar in how it works, except because Ontario kind of all the onus is on the tenant to bring things to the landlord tenant board. There's still that thing that Ontario lags behind Quebec in terms of renters' rights, but you are actually allowed to assign a lease to someone else. It's just because when a landlord in Ontario refuses, you have to go and wait potentially up to a year for the landlord and tenant board to even weigh in on the case.
And
I think
what,
that it ultimately
reasons,
makes it something people don't choose to do.
That makes a lot of sense. And do you know what reasons a landlord is allowed to refuse a lease transfer for?
The same reasons why you would refuse to rent to anyone. Like, they can't, like, if a landlord, for example, if a tenant says, I want to, and again, I am even less of a legal expert or legal advice than Alex is, so please do not take this without verifying that this applies to your place of residence. But
not less. The amount of legal advice I can give is zero. Please carry on.
No, we can both give the same amount of legal advice, but you at least have some knowledge. I have none. Other than my own life experience going through this process. So what I believe you do is, let's say I have my place and I say, I want Alex to be the new tenant because I want to leave a couple months early and Alex needs a place. So I go to my landlord. They say no. And I say, okay, what reason? And they reply back with some nonsense, or they don't reply. So we take it to the landlord tenant board. Obviously, it's a case by case basis. So like the landlord tenant board, you know, kind of could decide things. Like, it's not, they're there to decide things that don't have a clear cut, you know, decision, right? Like, so if the landlord comes to the landlord tenant board and says, I don't want them there because they're a woman, they're going to be denied. But if they come up with, you know, any valid reason, like any of those previous valid reasons I talked about, like certainly, oh, I'm moving into the unit or a family member or whatever, then those would certainly be taken as valid reasons. Or if the person happens to be like, I don't know, someone who's never paid rent before and has had 10 different cases in front of the landlord tenant board for refusing to pay rent, they'd probably say no to that. But technically they can't, the landlord has to have a good reason, and then good reason is up to the LTB to kind of determine, but it's pretty much like the way that it's set out is like the landlord tenant board is going to allow it as long as the landlord doesn't have like some really very like clearly valid reason to as to why this person shouldn't take over the lease. Because really, a landlord, if you think about it, right, like a landlord should love that their tenant found them a new tenant, right? Like, that's great for the landlord. The only reason it's not is because in the current climate, landlords know that they can increase the rent an exorbitant amount in between tenants. So it's still, we're certainly doing less than Quebec is to protect tenants, because it's on the landlord to do all of the, you know, filing paperwork and whatever it seems in Quebec, whereas in Ontario, it's up to you to assert your own rights.
But by no means is the situation in Quebec perfect either. You know, like the housing crisis here, and this is like especially especially concentrated in Montreal as a desirable big city. It's also the most Anglophone part of Quebec, basically, that you can live in. So you get lots of like Ontarians moving here because it's nicer. But the problem started from a better starting point, but it's very real, you know, and it's still getting worse. Leases in Quebec, rents in Quebec are becoming more expensive and the cost is growing rapidly. The government is trying to take away tenants' rights. All of these things are happening here as well. And the protections that we have, although, you know, they're arguably more robust than in many other provinces, are still very far from adequate to cement housing as a public need rather than as a commodity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we sort of talked a little bit at the start, and I'm sure we have two more episodes on the topic. We'll cover a lot more, but like we said, housing is overall getting worse no matter where you are. Sometimes it's getting worse in different ways. Like it's all a downhill slide, unfortunately, from what kind of looking around has taught me at least. But I definitely like the fact that there are places. I generally think of Canada as, and the research generally shows that Canada is one of the worst places to do anything real estate related, certainly being a renter around the world right now. But it's at least promising that there's some places in Canada where, like, the fact that they require the landlords in Quebec to be the ones who have to prove that they are abiding by renters' rights, as opposed to in Ontario, where renters have to prove that the landlords are breaking their rights. I think that's obviously the bare minimum, but at the same time, a really good thing that exists.
Yeah, no, I would agree. You know, an improvement is an improvement, even if it's not far enough. This has been Alex's one concession to incremental progress.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's at the end of the day, it's the same country, right? Like, as much as Quebec is probably the most unique or different scenario in the country, it's all the same nonsense, different flavor. We're all still under the capitalist oversight of the federal government, and so ultimately things can only change so much from one province to another. But I think that it's good that at least there is an example, because sometimes I feel and I know a lot of the times people look at Quebec as if it's basically a separate country because there is such a cultural difference at times, but it's easier to look at a province within the same country and say, oh, Ontario could make these improvements because look, it works literally right next door, versus picking, I don't know, Austria, some country that is in a different continent, different everything, and trying to apply like their, especially, I mean, the things that you were talking about, like the built environment would be completely different. Much easier and beneficial to be referencing some things close by, because I think there'd be a more likelihood that it'll be a successful implementation as opposed to taking stuff from somewhere that is a completely different context.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And exactly with what you said, that the kind of attitude that drives housing laws across Canada and across a lot of the rest of the world as well is the kind of like capitalist, liberal, market-based whatever mess we have. Well, obviously we will get way deeper into that in our next couple of episodes, but this has been a really fun, really enlightening kind of dive into what housing laws are like, maybe not across all of Canada, but at least across the two most populous provinces therein. And
100%.
Yeah. And I think gives us a really good jumping off point for some of the more high level theoretical issues.
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing that I would hope people take away from this, for anyone listening, is even though I like I said, over the last 4 or 5 years, I've spent more months actively looking for a rental place in Ontario than I haven't, just because you've got to start looking a couple months before your lease ends so that you're not stuck homeless or back at your parents' place. And the amount of research that I did was quite comprehensive. Like I did a decent amount of work. Like I knew that there were a lot of, I worked in our campus housing office for 2 years. I knew that there were a lot of important things to make sure I knew about. And still, in researching for this episode, I learned some more things that I didn't learn in previous things. And some of it is because I've never faced a rent eviction, so I've never really looked closely at those rules. But I think it just emphasizes how complex these things are. And for an issue as crucial as housing, like you can't do much in your life if you don't have housing. You can't do anything if you have no housing, pretty much. Like, there's just so many barriers to you. And certainly finding acceptable housing is even, you know, an even harder step to achieve. I think it just emphasizes how important it is to do research, to find someone, whether it's a lawyer or a realtor or someone that you trust that can advise you through this process if you're facing anything in this realm, whether you're looking for a place, you're facing issues with a landlord, whatever. You can never do too much research to know your rights.
Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of spaces on the internet, you know, Facebook groups, subreddits, you name it, right? Dedicated
subreddits are one of the best places for sure for this stuff.
Yeah. So if you want a starting point to inform yourself of your rights as a tenant, or, I mean, even if we have any landlords or prospective landlords listening, right, to inform yourself of your obligations and, you know, hopefully to not willfully violate tenants' rights. But that's like a good,
we can dream.
That's a good, like, accessible direction to get started, and, you know, great kind of place to ask questions.
Absolutely. And I believe we'll be getting into the nitty gritty in the next episode about more specifics around landlords and landlord corporations and things like that. So if you found this interesting, this is kind of the, I'll say the amuse-bouche to cater to our Quebec references in this episode. This was the starting point for the next two episodes. So if you enjoyed it, please hit the follow, subscribe, listen, whatever the button is on the app that you're using, and make sure that you come back in about 2 weeks for our next episode, where we'll be going even more in depth and probably finding even more ridiculous stories and laws to talk about how the housing market is going in the year 2024.
Alors, au revoir et à la prochaine.